Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2011. English for Speakers of Other Languages, Intermediate 2. Section A, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the discussion between two people and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 1, before you start.
In the past few years, we have seen food riots on three continents. Food inflation has rocketed, and experts predict that by 2050, if things don't change, we will see mass starvation across the globe. By the middle of the century, the world population will have reached 9 billion, and food production will need to be doubled. What needs to happen to prevent planet Earth from going hungry? Perhaps the best solution would be for all of us to grow food in our own backyards, frankly, in any spare bit of land available. Around the world, people are looking for new ways to produce their own food. Here in Britain, the Grow Your Own food movement has flourished as people turn away from expensive imports. In West Yorkshire, Pam Warhurst and her team have done just that. They've been planting fruit and vegetables all over their small market town.
Vegetables and fruit are springing up everywhere. We're transforming public flower beds into community herb gardens and vegetable patches. We've got herbs at the station, we've got a lovely gooseberry walk, apples and pears around the school playing field. We've got carrots outside the old surgery, beans and strawberries growing in boats in every schoolyard. We've got a potato bed just down by the station.
And it's not just for show. Pam is part of a movement called Incredible Edible Todmorden. They want their town to produce all their own vegetables within the next decade.
We've got big dreams. In 10 years, we want to make our town self-sufficient in food. There's the potential for us to look after ourselves in our town and encourage people, especially children, to eat more healthy food. Businesses, schools, farmers and the community are all involved. We grow and campaign for local food.
And they're not alone. Homegrown may just be catching on in Britain, but in Havana, Cuba, nearly 2 million people rely on urban farms to grow their own fruit and vegetables. For decades, Cuba used to import nearly all of its food because trade with Russia, known then as the Soviet Union, was heavily subsidised. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba had to change. In order to do that, it had to grow its own food and use every tiny bit of space. More than 200 urban farms have sprung up all over the bustling city of Havana. Cooperatives produce tons of food for local people. It's healthy, free, and the project provides jobs. It's very important for Cuba to produce its own food when there are such high prices for food globally. This is a sustainable solution, and it gives the country a sense of security. Cuba is now 90% self-sufficient in fruit and vegetables. This may not seem the answer to a global food crisis, but it's the principle that's important. The principle that local people are taking responsibility for their own food needs. In the past few years, we have seen food riots on three continents. Food inflation has rocketed, and experts predict that by 2050, if things don't change, we will see mass starvation across the globe. By the middle of the century, the world population will have reached 9 billion, and food production will need to be doubled. What needs to happen to prevent planet Earth from going hungry? Perhaps the best solution would be for all of us to grow food in our own backyards, frankly, in any spare bit of land available. Around the world, people are looking for new ways to produce their own food. Here in Britain, the Grow Your Own food movement has flourished as people turn away from expensive imports. In West Yorkshire, Pam Warhurst and her team have done just that. They've been planting fruit and vegetables all over their small market town.
Vegetables and fruit are springing up everywhere. We're transforming public flower beds into community herb gardens and vegetable patches. We've got herbs at the station, we've got a lovely gooseberry walk, apples and pears around the school playing field. We've got carrots outside the old surgery, beans and strawberries growing in boats in every schoolyard. We've got a potato bed just down by the station.
And it's not just for show. Pam is part of a movement called Incredible Edible Todmorden. They want their town to produce all their own vegetables within the next decade.
We've got big dreams. In 10 years, we want to make our town self-sufficient in food. There's the potential for us to look after ourselves in our town and encourage people, especially children, to eat more healthy food. Businesses, schools, farmers and the community are all involved. We grow and campaign for local food.
And they're not alone. Homegrown may just be catching on in Britain, but in Havana, Cuba, nearly 2 million people rely on urban farms to grow their own fruit and vegetables. For decades, Cuba used to import nearly all of its food because trade with Russia, known then as the Soviet Union, was heavily subsidised. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba had to change. In order to do that, it had to grow its own food and use every tiny bit of space. More than 200 urban farms have sprung up all over the bustling city of Havana. Cooperatives produce tons of food for local people. It's healthy, free, and the project provides jobs. It's very important for Cuba to produce its own food when there are such high prices for food globally. This is a sustainable solution, and it gives the country a sense of security. Cuba is now 90% self-sufficient in fruit and vegetables. This may not seem the answer to a global food crisis, but it's the principle that's important. The principle that local people are taking responsibility for their own food needs.
Listen to the presenter and the conversation between two people and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 2, before you start.
Holidays abroad can be a mixed blessing. Yes, of course there's the sun, if that's what you like, the exotic food, the broadening of your horizons. There is also airport hell, delays and lost luggage, financial overstretch and the strain, and perhaps this is worst of all, of having to enjoy yourself when you've spent so much money. But what if you could have your holiday cake and eat it? All of the former and none of the latter. Well, driven by necessity, Claire Wade thinks she's found an answer, and Bob Carter has been to visit her at home in Norfolk.
We are sitting here in front of the computer screen, watching the sun beginning to dip low in the sky, and we see a group of people walking along some wooden walkways. We follow them, hearing the wood creak beneath us. The walkways stretch through the dunes until you reach a floodlit beach. This is Summerland Beach.
So this is the Australia virtual holiday. You've got day one, they end up in Melbourne, and then day two, they're going to go to the set for Neighbours in Ramsay Street.
Claire Wade's taking me on holiday without leaving her sofa. She's behind Holidays from Home. Its intention is to give people who can't travel a taste of foreign climes. Supported by the National Lottery, it aims to bring the travel experience to you.
We've got two holidays at the moment, one to New York and one to Australia. And basically the holiday allows them to virtually experience a different destination. It's a specially written guide which describes the holiday as if they're really there. So what it is like to get on the plane and arrive. And we've got web cameras so you can actually watch things in real time. It's the next best thing to travel.
I've taken a real rather than virtual trip to meet Claire at home in a village near Norwich because she can't get out much. She's had ME since the age of 10 and she's now 25. She was 18 when she and her mum were left behind while the rest of the family went to Greece on holiday.
I was so upset. I didn't know how I was going to get through a week with them away and me being stuck in bed. I thought, well, if I can't take a normal holiday, then maybe I could bring a holiday to me. I got some books about Greece from the library and Mum put pictures up round the room and we had food like Greek yogurt and feta. We borrowed Greek pottery from friends and we also got cups and plates. We even paddled our feet in a foot spa and pretended it was the sea. It was completely surreal. We just had the most amazing week and created some fantastic memories. I decided then that I would like to start doing virtual holidays and I wrote the Australia one for some friends with ME who were also bedbound, and then I went on to do the New York one for a friend's 21st birthday. And so I decided I would then use those holidays to help out other people.
There's now a Norfolk-wide trio of holidays from home. So I've done Australia, I've been to New York, now where do I fancy? How about a trip down to South America? Virtual South America?
Holidays abroad can be a mixed blessing. Yes, of course there's the sun, if that's what you like, the exotic food, the broadening of your horizons. There is also airport hell, delays and lost luggage, financial overstretch and the strain, and perhaps this is worst of all, of having to enjoy yourself when you've spent so much money. But what if you could have your holiday cake and eat it? All of the former and none of the latter. Well, driven by necessity, Claire Wade thinks she's found an answer, and Bob Carter has been to visit her at home in Norfolk.
We are sitting here in front of the computer screen, watching the sun beginning to dip low in the sky, and we see a group of people walking along some wooden walkways. We follow them, hearing the wood creak beneath us. The walkways stretch through the dunes until you reach a floodlit beach. This is Summerland Beach.
So this is the Australia virtual holiday. You've got day one, they end up in Melbourne, and then day two, They're going to go to the set for Neighbours in Ramsay Street.
Claire Wade's taking me on holiday without leaving her sofa. She's behind Holidays from Home. Its intention is to give people who can't travel a taste of foreign climes. Supported by the National Lottery, it aims to bring the travel experience to you.
We've got two holidays at the moment, one to New York and one to Australia. And basically the holiday allows them to virtually experience a different destination. It's a specially written guide which describes the holiday as if they're really there. So what it is like to get on the plane and arrive. And we've got web cameras so you can actually watch things in real time. It's the next best thing to travel.
I've taken a real rather than virtual trip to meet Claire at home in a village near Norwich because she can't get out much. She's had ME since the age of 10 and she's now 25. She was 18 when she and her mum were left behind while the rest of the family went to Greece on holiday.
I was so upset. I didn't know how I was going to get through a week with them away and me being stuck in bed. I thought, well, if I can't take a normal holiday, then maybe I could bring a holiday to me. I got some books about Greece from the library and Mum put pictures up round the room and we had food like Greek yoghurt and feta. We borrowed Greek pottery from friends and we also got cups and plates. We even paddled our feet in a foot spa and pretended it was the sea. It was completely surreal. We just had the most amazing week and created some fantastic memories. I decided then that I would like to start doing virtual holidays and I wrote the Australia one for some friends with ME who were also bedbound, and then I went on to do the New York one for a friend's 21st birthday. And so I decided that I would then use those holidays to help out other people.
There's now a Norfolk-wide trio of holidays from home. So I've done Australia, I've been to New York. Now where do I fancy? How about a trip down to South America? Virtual South America?
Recording 3. Listen to the discussion and answer the questions that follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 3, before you start.
So it looks like the next few days are going to be wet and windy, especially in the north, though the north of England and south-eastern Scotland will escape the worst of it. Elsewhere, fairly dull and dismal, and I certainly wouldn't plan any picnics or barbecues. Back to you, Craig.
OK, thanks, Nadia. Now, just a reminder that you're listening to the 11 o'clock show with me, Craig Lawson, on Capital 2 FM. And now I'd like all of you listeners to meet today's guests. There's been a lot of talk recently about reintroducing species of wild animals to the countryside, so I thought we'd have a look at that. With me in the studio is Marcia Chisholm of the Wild Nature Trust. Morning, Marcia.
Hi, good to be here.
And Peter Johnson of the National Farmers Forum.
Morning, Craig.
Okay, Marcia, could you tell the listeners what the Wild Nature Trust is all about?
Well, Craig, let's start with this idea of wilderness. Large parts of Britain, especially in Scotland, Northern England and Wales, are fairly empty, and there's a popular belief that they represent natural land untouched by human hands. In fact, that's rubbish. People have been affecting them for hundreds, thousands of years.
Sure. What sort of things are you talking about?
For a start, a lot of types of animals were hunted out. The bears, the wild boar, then the wolves. Other species were killed for food, like the reindeer. And others just died out because of the change in the habitat.
OK, Marcia, so what are you proposing?
Well, what we're mainly interested in at the moment is the reintroduction of mammals.
Have any mammals been reintroduced?
One or two, and others have reintroduced themselves. Wild boar, they're like wild pigs, are now living free in the south of England after some escape from farms.
So what's the next animal on your list?
Well, it isn't quite like that, but there's been a lot of debate recently about reintroducing the wolf.
Ah, yes, controversial.
Uh-huh. A lot of people are frightened by the idea, but in fact, wolf attacks on humans are extremely rare. None of the countries with wolves have any authenticated accounts of a wolf killing a human being.
But they do attack sheep, don't they?
Yes, they do, sometimes.
Peter, how do you feel about this?
Well, like any other farmer, I'm concerned. Wolves certainly kill sheep, but it's not just that. They're likely to kill any other animal they come across. Cattle, ponies, pigs, even dogs and cats.
Yes, they do, sometimes, and there's obviously a management issue there.
I don't think a farmer who's had a calf or lamb killed by wolves is going to call it a management issue.
Yes, Peter, I can understand that. But tell me, Marcia, what do you see as the advantage of reintroducing wolves?
Well, I take Peter's point about farm and domestic animals, but wolves are much more likely to hunt deer, and Britain is overpopulated with deer.
Can't they be controlled in other ways?
That's done already. About 160,000 deer are shot every year in Britain, but it isn't nearly enough. Wolves would reduce deer numbers to their natural balance.
Okay, this is just a personal thing. I go camping sometimes and I don't know if I'd sleep easily with wolves howling in the hills.
Sure, I understand, but you have to remember that many countries in Europe have wolves, not to mention North America, and they don't put people off camping. Bears are much more of a problem because they come looking for food. Wolves are quite shy, really.
Well, it's a complex issue and I can't see any easy answers.
There's a very easy answer. Don't bring back wolves.
Well, thanks to both of you. Now, if any of the listeners would like to get involved in this debate, you can send us an email at...
So it looks like the next few days are going to be wet and windy, especially in the north, though the north of England and southeastern Scotland will escape the worst of it. Elsewhere, fairly dull and dismal, and I certainly wouldn't plan any picnics or barbecues. Back to you, Craig.
Okay, thanks, Nadia. Now, just a reminder that you're listening to the 11 o'clock show with me, Craig Lawson, on Capital 2 FM. And now I'd like all of you listeners to meet today's guests. There's been a lot of talk recently about reintroducing species of wild animals to the countryside, so I thought we'd have a look at that. With me in the studio is Marcia Chisholm of the Wild Nature Trust. Morning, Marcia.
Hi, good to be here.
And Peter Johnson of the National Farmers Forum.
Morning, Craig.
Okay, Marcia, could you tell the listeners what the Wild Nature Trust is all about?
Well, Craig, let's start with this idea of wilderness. Large parts of Britain, especially in Scotland, Northern England and Wales, are fairly empty, and there's a popular belief that they represent natural land untouched by human hands. In fact, that's rubbish. People have been affecting them for hundreds, thousands of years.
Sure. What sort of things are you talking about?
For a start, a lot of types of animals were hunted out. The bears, the wild boar, then the wolves. Other species were killed for food, like the reindeer. and others just died out because of the change in the habitat.
OK, Marcia, so what are you proposing?
Well, what we're mainly interested in at the moment is the reintroduction of mammals.
Have any mammals been reintroduced?
One or two, and others have reintroduced themselves. Wild boar, they're like wild pigs, are now living free in the south of England after some escape from farms.
So what's the next animal on your list?
Well, it isn't quite like that, but there's been a lot of debate recently about reintroducing the wolf.
Ah, yes, controversial.
Uh-huh. A lot of people are frightened by the idea, but in fact, wolf attacks on humans are extremely rare. None of the countries with wolves have any authenticated accounts of a wolf killing a human being.
But they do attack sheep, don't they?
Yes, they do, sometimes.
Peter, how do you feel about this?
Well, like any other farmer, I'm concerned. Wolves certainly kill sheep, but it's not just that. They're likely to kill any other animal they come across. Cattle, ponies, pigs, even dogs and cats.
Yes, they do, sometimes, and there's obviously a management issue there.
I don't think a farmer who's had a calf or lamb killed by wolves is going to call it a management issue.
Yes, Peter, I can understand that. But tell me, Marcia, what do you see as the advantage of reintroducing wolves?
Well, I take Peter's point about farm and domestic animals, but wolves are much more likely to hunt deer, and Britain is overpopulated with deer.
Can't they be controlled in other ways?
That's done already. About 160,000 deer are shot every year in Britain, but it isn't nearly enough. Wolves would reduce deer numbers to their natural balance.
OK, this is just a personal thing. I go camping sometimes and I don't know if I'd sleep easily with wolves howling in the hills.
Sure, I understand, but you have to remember that many countries in Europe have wolves, not to mention North America, and they don't put people off camping. Bears are much more of a problem because they come looking for food. Wolves are quite shy, really.
Well, it's a complex issue and I can't see any easy answers.
There's a very easy answer. Don't bring back wolves.
Well, thanks to both of you. Now, if any of the listeners would like to get involved in this debate, you can send us an email at
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.